Two rulings that we appeal, we submit, seriously weaken our judicial branch of government's ability, this branch of government's ability, to protect lives and safety of people against the most dangerous, egregious, and harmful type of conduct. When the court basically took away $10 million, it did it with the best of intentions. But it did it without regard to the standards this court established, and it did so in Chester Park.
Your brief seems to indicate that you were coerced into accepting that. Is that accurate?
I think that as well intended as it was, I think it really does come down in these circumstances to a form of judicial pressure. And I ask the court, as we consider this, that we see this as a derogation, not just of such a part, but a derogation of a property judgment. I would ask this court to try to put yourself in a position of a plaintiff litigant. At least I put this board up here, that it shows that when, in 1996, when a very fine judge said, you've got two choices. You can accept a $10 million reduction or face a new trial.
That's what always happens to us in remittiture.
But in this case, the process found punitive damages were not excessive.
Yeah.
Under those circumstances, wouldn't it have been better for you to have said no, I'll face a new trial and then appeal directly?
You know, in hindsight, maybe. But, you know, think of our position. 6 years is on by, two trials, two appeals, countless motions. The family went close.
Now, what exactly is the reason that you feel that you do have the right to appeal the entire issue? Is it the fact that the trial says found cancer damage is not to be accessible, or is it the fact that you were coerced? And what exactly would you want us to put in the story?
Well, I very simply ask the court firstly to reaffirm Chester Park. And that is the requirement that if there's no passion threshold, no exemption, then courts shouldn't be allowed, no matter how well intentioned they may be, to take away, in this case, 40% of the judgment. And that, it seems to me, if we stress the idea of abuse of discretion that far, the very idea of discretion, or it seems to me that it's almost impossible to see how you could abuse discretion. Secondly, we ask the court, Justice Rennick and members of the court, we ask the court to hold that before a plaintiff in the first prong of our argument, before a plaintiff should be held bound by a consent to a remitter, that remitter has to be proper. Otherwise, as one of the questions suggested, the litigant in the position of the foundation and Mrs. Whiteman are, in effect, in this case, told, look, you got a judgment, we're taking away $10 million, but you still have to have a third trial or fight on appeal to retain it. That's a derogation of the judgment.
You've made the manifestly excessive argument well in your brief and the case law. Why should we adopt the Wisconsin rule? And what is the breakdown between the states on the Wisconsin rule on that issue?
If I may, I didn't say it in the beginning, I'd like to reserve about half of my time for this. But it seems to me the best reason, Justice Douglas and members of the court, for considering the advantages offered by the Wisconsin rule resides in the old maxim, when the reasons for a rule ceases to exist, the rule should cease to exist. As best we can determine, the reason behind finding a plaintiff and not the defendant is the mistaken notion that in the context of remittance, consent is similar to a contractual consent entered into between parties to a bargain, when in fact this isn't what happened at all. I mean, that was, this wasn't, it was consent for only the formalistic sense.
But it's the It's interesting. The argument is interesting, but the plaintiff does have an option. As you conceded a couple minutes ago, your option would have been to challenge that forced remitter on appeal with the order for new trial. There's some risk involved in that you would indeed have to get a new trial. But the weighing of it, to me, bears on the consensualness of it, that there is something to weigh. It's not a forced thing. There has to be some weighing. There's choices, both having good sides and bad sides.
No question of choice, but it's a painful and unfair choice because we need Justice Cook and members of the court for requiring consent under the common law rule is the requirement that the plaintiff should be required to give up the constitutional right to a jury trial. So it's really a formality that has been built into the law. It seems to me with a mistaken notion in mind that this is really a situation like a contract, and therefore parties shouldn't be permitted to renege on a contract.
The argument, though, sort of seems like it's directed at the whole concept of remitter, and you're not asking us to say that, boy, that's a terrible concept. I mean, it is firmly grounded in our jurisprudence. So remitters are what they are. You're not saying shouldn't have those.
The only thing I would say in response to that is, well, maybe in a sense it's been there for a long time.
Yes.
I can find no decision going all the way back to the beginning of the common law rule in Ohio where it's been carefully analyzed by this court.
But that isn't your proposition of law. Thou shalt have no more remitter in Ohio.
No, it's not. Our proposition of law is first to bind a plaintiff. There should be a real remitter. First, there has to be a valid remitter, a proper remitter. Here there was no proper remitter. Mm-hmm.
But we do have we just talked about that. There is an avenue where there is an improper remitter. In this case, the plaintiff didn't choose the avenue of challenging that remitter, the basis for ordering remitter, that it was non-excessive.
Yeah, that's right. And I would say after this is a human enterprise.
Oh, yeah.
When you're in the position of these people want closure,
I mean, that's great. There was a good reason to make that choice. It's a choice.
Yeah. There's good reason to make it. You have to consider matters of the court, whether it's really fair, whether it's good jurisprudence, good policy, mm-hmm. to continue a rule. I mean, even in the face of the improper remitted to buying the plaintiff, coming back to Justice Douglas.
Yeah, that's really the question I wanted to come to. That doesn't have anything to do with the Wisconsin rule, which you and I were discussing. The Wisconsin rule says that if somebody appeals, and you win on appeal, then the full amount should be restored, doesn't it?
It does. In other words, what does Justice Douglas, and this is the type that I see as a strong trend toward greater fairness in the matter of remitting to the Wisconsin rule. So all it does, really, is it says, look, once you get a decision by a trial judge, either part has the right, if the defendant appeals, to get a review, to seek a review of the propriety of that.
Okay, now moving to the last issue, and that's the interest on the punitive damages. How do we know, how can we show by the record or otherwise, that the trial judge didn't take that issue into consideration in determining the amount of the remittiture?
You know, as I reflected on that, I think he probably did. The reason for it is, it seems to me that as a practical matter, what interest relief on punitive damages is, it didn't remember. I mean, it's what it comes down to. I mean, in this case, it's $25 million for 2 years at 10%. It's a $5 million remitter without the benefit of review under the Chester Park standard. And what is particularly offensive as a matter of policy here is that it affects turns over to the defendant. It confers on the defendant the power to determine when the face of the defendant is paid in the defendant, and in what amount. But here we have, of course, the defendant has a right to appeal, but if the plaintiff has no consent, no consent on this iota.
Wait a minute, I thought I just heard you say that he probably did take it into consideration. Is it your position that if he had granted interest on the punitive damages, that the remittiture would have been greater?
No, I don't think that's no. What I'm saying is that when you give the defendant interest-free use of the remittance, the defendant should say, Well, there's no point in doing anything other than, and particularly to hire the award. In other words, the most egregious wrongdoer gets the biggest wage.
Yeah, I understand all that, but that's not, no, you're not, because that's not the legal issue. The legal issue is should there be interest pursuant to the interest judgment statute on punitive damages.
Yes.
All right. Now, if you say that you think he took it into consideration in saying no interest on the punitive damages, that would only lead to he would have given a greater remittiture if he had allowed interest, wouldn't it?
Well, I think you could reach that conclusion, yes.
All right, now how do we not reach the conclusion that the interest was factored into the remittiture?
Well, I was clear to the record. I don't find anything in the record to indicate that was the reason. The court stated as the reason the fact that there shouldn't be an interest on penalty, but acknowledged that he could find no authority in support of that proposition.
Well, the only authority is in the reasoning that you assess a penalty, you size it up, and then that's the amount that is necessary to deter and punish. So interest on that amount, I think the suggestion maybe in the proposition that you offer is that there should be a punishment. I mean, arguably, there's a punishment for appealing that punishment by increasing it for the time that it takes to appeal.
I don't think there should be a reward.
Well,
I don't think there should be a reward to the defendant, particularly the defendant who is guilty of this kind of egregious conduct for appealing.
Or, yeah, you can look at it as a reward for taking the time to appeal, which assumes bad faith. And we could say that everybody has that right to appeal.
Everybody has the right to appeal. Mm-hmm. I don't see any justification for the matter. If we really believe, as I do, that the importance of punitive damages is actually important social goals, and I strongly believe then it seems to me that we should do it the right way. This represents very bad policy, very bad approach to punitive damages. It literally gives to the defendant, the kids remember, ignores the standards in Chester Park. I find it very difficult to find any justification whatsoever for using this kind of approach to remember. There would be no way at the time that the interest free release was given, even in terms of how much the extra kids remember would amount to. So, what we've got is very,
let me interrupt you. If back to the Wisconsin rule, if we were to hold the plaintiff to this agreement, whatever you want, not a contract, but this agreement to the remittitor, and not permit the defendant to appeal the amount of remittitor punitive damages, do we not comply with the Wisconsin rule? Is that a different application? That go beyond the Wisconsin rule, do you think? That's what I thought the Wisconsin rule was good for.
Well, as I understand the Wisconsin rule, it merely says that once you have a remittance, then either party, the plaintiff and the defendant, may seek an intelligent view of the propriety of that remittance. And that just seems to me fair, far fairer, and it has the advantages of judicial economy and creating incentives for both parties to sit down and get not just the litigation resolved, but to get the underlying conflict that's generated between the damage and change.
Does the Wisconsin have the same policy that Ohio has where you require the plaintiff to agree to the minister or to the trial? The same part of your
my understanding, Justice Resnick, that what happens either part, if the defendant appeals the remittance, then the plaintiff, under the Wisconsin approach, also has the right to ask the appellate court to determine whether or not the remittance is proper. And that's all it does. And it just seems to me it's so much more fair. And it effectuates the objective of punitive damage so much more effectively than the common law rule, which, as I mentioned earlier, based on a mistaken assumption that this is like a contract.
Does the shall be language of 1343.03b, could it arguably be the shall be, it should apply to the amount to be computed, or is your argument shall be as a mandatory provision that it shall be assessed? It says shall be computed. It doesn't say shall be assessed, does it? I guess my question is it discretionary?
I don't mean to be
particular. Well, if you don't have a better argument than that, then you lose.
I see the language as mandatory.
It's difficult to say the word shall be or not mandatory.
It strikes me as mandatory, but in all honesty, I
would
never have used it. Shall be. You've used it a lot, Mr. Murray. About 30 seconds, unless you get questions from the court, then you can talk to Ned. Tonight. Our man.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Yes.
And first of all, I would like to thank the court for permitting me to argue. I consider it a state honor coming from Pennsylvania and being Philadelphia. And I hope to myself that too many remarks about that. I would like to reserve 2 minutes, if I may. And I'd like to deal immediately with the remittance point. The court obviously is interested in. And I'd like to read to the court its unanimous opinion in Siena, ordered by Justice Sweeney, where a party voluntarily chooses to accept a remittance rather than a new trial, it cannot challenge that remittance or appeal. This rule is fundamentally fair and simply binds the party to a selection. On that sentence, Justice Resnick, Justice, and Justice Piper. That case was based on Iron Railroad versus Maryland, a much older Ohio Supreme Court case, where the court said exactly the same thing. What is true? That there are some other jurisdictions that do not follow the rule of remittance, the Ohio rule. That is known as the so-called Wisconsin. Every federal court in the nation follows what Justice Sweeney said in the remarks that I have just read.
But how does that factor in the Chester Park case, which says that one of the requirements is that it has to be manifestly excessive, and this trial judge found specifically it was not.
Well, I don't think, sir, that he did find specific people. Let's assume that he did. If you read that first sentence, he really did find that. He said, I cannot say that this is excessive under the Ohio case. And then he went through the other portions of punitive damages that are very important. The concept of deterrence,
one of my colleagues said, perhaps he was sandbagging the court. I don't like to use that term. I don't think proper in this court. But I think it might be proper to say he may have induced error, and I don't think that's right if he did induce error on the part of the trial court. I don't think he did, but you might arguably say he did. Now on the interest point.
Well, before you do that, the trial court specifically cites the Chester Park case and goes on and says, by the Ohio Supreme Court in Chester Park, as follows, and then lays the law out, but not appearing to be influenced by passion or prejudice, and then specifically finds that it was not, he says he cannot find that it was excessive. Isn't that one of the requirements before you ever get to the Price Waterhouse case?
I think Chester Park is really repeating what this court said in Fiona. What it says in effect is that if a verdict is reached by passion or prejudice, it's void. It's set aside. But if the verdict is accepted or appears to the judge who has been sued, the judge has an alternative of preparing a new trial, or if the plaintiff consents, granting a remittance. And that's what this court has said for almost 100 years.
The difficulty with the, and with, like Justice Douglas, with the decision of the trial court here, where he starts out with saying, I can't say that it's excessive, but later determines on the other potential ground of is what amount is sufficient to deter and punish, he finds that this amount is sufficient to deter and punish. You know, it's difficult to say that he didn't implicitly then find that any amount over the sufficient amount to deter and punish is then excessive.
I agree with you.
But their language is, you know, that...
Mm-hmm. To me, Mr. Murray is a very experienced lawyer. In fact, he was more experienced than I am. And he could have said to the trial judge, I think you're dead wrong on the damages, and I'd rather take my chances with a new trial. And I don't know what the trial judge would have done at that time. Or he could have said, well, I'll only accept the remainder if you add this interest.
That's a $15 million gamble, isn't it?
That's his judgment. Perhaps that's what his client wanted to avoid, and she or he had the right to do it. I'd like to move on to the interest point. Now, this court has said repeatedly that interest on a penalty is to be discouraged. And Justice Resnick said in Salala, you're talking about prejudgment. Awarding prejudgment interest on punitive damages would not serve the compensatory purposes of prejudgment interest, and this is the important thing, nor the exemplary purposes of punitive damages.
But how can you apply that to post-judgment?
You will find because of your own philosophy. You then go to one at the bottom of the page, and I think your philosophy is correct. Because an award of punitive damages is over and above the amount adequate to compensate the plaintiff, there is no need to award interest on the punitive damages in order to compensate the plaintiff further for a delay in payment. And I think you were right there. Now, that's not to say you can't reconsider it. But even if you wish to reconsider the rule, I think that my friend still has to deal with a remittance, as he just pointed out. He knew very well when he sent it to the remittance that it didn't contain an interest element. He should have said to the trial judge, well, judge, I think I'll go along with that. One condition, you put another sentence in that says that interest is wrong from the time he entered it. He didn't do that. He now comes to you both. You weren't there. You know what was going through the trial judge's mind. He said, well, you were asked what the trial judge did that. And I think that's inconsistent with what Your Honor said in the level, and certainly it's inconsistent for teachers.
When you say that your learned opponent here didn't say that to the trial judge, I take it you mean by appealing it.
The trial judge was there. He had rendered his opinion. His opinion showed that there was a competitor. And then he said, I'll give you 10 days to think about it. So there was no rush. He could have filed.
You're saying in making his choice.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Because we don't recognize motions for reconsideration in this in Ohio. So you're not saying that.
He's making his choice.
All right.
I'd like to move on to what I think is really the part of this matter, and that is that the word here is excessive, and I believe that it violates both Ohio law and due process. I think you already know that this is the highest use of navigable words, which is offered in Ohio thus far, and so far as proportionality is concerned, 2,400 to 15 million. It's not only off the charts, no court has ever sustained any.
You're also right, probably.
But when you come right down to it, I don't think it answers my friend's argument, because the issue is what was the common law? And he relies heavily, as your honor did, on Moraine. So if you look at Moraine versus Field, State Marine Line, putting aside the point that that was a maritime issue, here is what Justice Carlin said, page 380. In American common law, as in English, no civil action lies from injury which results in death. And later on in his opinion, Justice Carlin refers to the insurance company versus Crane, 1877 case. Here's what Justice Hunt said. At the common law, no civil action lies for injury which results in the death of a party injured. The authorities are so numerous and so uniform to that proposition that by the common law, no civil action lies for injury which results in death, that it is impossible to speak of it as a proposition that's open to question. So I really think, Your Honor, and I'm very interested in your opinion, that really what you're saying is that when Lord Ellenborough laid down his pick in the Baker case, he erred. He used a base that was really not valid, certainly not in America.
The felony, merger doctrine.
Yeah, you may very
which
well
has no application at all.
But this court has said for almost 100 years, we have to look at what was understood to be the common law when the Ohio adopted. And as Justice Carlin points out in the very case you rely on, it was clear beyond Seville that the common law said you can't have a wrongful death. Now, if you take that away, and that's something that Your Honor has to decide, then you're to the point of having this monstrous verdict of $25 million paid for the damage of $2,400. Now, I'm sure somebody's going to ask you the question. Do you think we can't look beyond the $2,400? I think we can. Yes. Do you think you could look? I hope I'm not fired by my client for saying that, but I think you would on a fence. But I don't think you can look to such an extent that you invalidate criminal defense act. But obviously, if you can do that, then any time that there's a wrongful death, somebody will obtain a cause of action for personal damage and seek the whole unit of damages. Well, obviously, the legislature didn't intend that, and I don't believe this court in affirming the legislature. I think you affirmed them on that. Many times I've heard of Justice Douglas on that. He studied this question more than I did. So that you are up against an enormous verdict. Now, we go to the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court...
Yeah, so can I interrupt you?
Disabled train.
It is absolute. They have radio communication. two trains at least came through there that night. Any number of employees knew the situation, and they did absolutely nothing. And if I could just conclude on this, I just don't understand how it's possible that 6 years later, the second jury found there was still no explanation of how the railroad could possibly have ignored the 15 minutes and the express warning that there was a death sentence. And it just shows that this, that we proved conclusively this was their policy, it's their practice, it's been their policy and practice. And I would respect this committee that if ever there was a case to justify 25 years or more, maybe I can prove by 21, that the court found, the trial court, that the strategy that they employed at second trial 6 years later was an attempt to repudiate the findings of the first jury. This is an entrenched corporate attitude that threatens the lives of people. I urge you to reinstate the 25 million. Thank you.
Thank you. You've used your time. You have 30 seconds as well. You're
used 30 seconds to say that that was not the point. That there was a rule in place that the on which, when a train is like this, all trains are stopped. That was not invoked by these three lower level employees. But they were confused by the rule that no one could say that the conscious effort on their part to endanger the life of
them. But weren't they also informed by a police officer who had gone through the fact that
they were informed, yes, and then their statement was told we wrote what is known as Form D, which tops all trains. Now, there's no evidence as to why this train went through, but to suggest that these three lower employees were responsible for the failure to alert for me to found no words for
it. Council, before you sit down, we apparently have a dispute as to whether or not there is in the record, was in the record, evidence with respect to profits and net worth of corporation.
I didn't hear the net worth. I know the net worth was there. I didn't think that there was evidence of profits.
If I'm wrong, I can't correct it, and I apologize. I'm looking for some fact. And this court has ordered a remitter in a punitive damage case. They don't have that worth of the
expense. Yes, this court, your court has ordered remitters to on top of a remitter when your judgment, you thought even the remitted figure was too high. As a matter of fact, in the case that he has tried,
One more before you sit down. Did you, is the case you were talking about that you thought Justice Resnick might ask you a question on is Loyola?
No, I'm going to ask about the Williams case because the damages there were $15,000.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
$15,000.
The reason I ask you is because you argue the Loyola case pretty strongly to us. Is there any place in that case that deals with 1343.03b rather than C?
Yes, I do think that Justice Resnick mentions both of them.
I don't think so.
She doesn't think so.
I don't think so either.
My memory's not as good as hers. She wrote the opinion, and I defer to her. Thank you.